Danny didn't get to read any more highlights as the newscast abruptly switched back to a visibly shaken anchorwoman who announced they would be right back. Commercial. John clicked off the TV and I let out a long, resigned sigh. Without a word, we put on our jackets and walked out the door. We stopped by my tool shed. The morbidly obese security guard at the Channel 5 building told us Wexler had left early. We almost gave up at that point, but we got a huge break in the case when John thought to look up Wexler's home address in the phone book. After getting lost briefly, we pulled into the lot of Wexler's building and found a Buick with a license plate 5SPRTS, which, after some debate, we decided must stand for Channel 5 Sports, and that it must be his. "You still got the mints?" John asked as we strode up to the four-story apartment building. "You knock on the door, and when Wexler answers, you cram some mints down his throat. If he's acting normal, we don't do anything, just find out what he knows. About Molly and, you know, everything else that's happening. If it's something we can fix with a mint, then fine. If not, then we leave Dr. Marconi a voicemail and drive until we find a town that doesn't keep showing up in books with titles like True Tales of the Bizarre. Marconi can come down and do a whole show on it, for all I care. Write another book." I had my old-school ghetto blaster. John was carrying a satchel containing several items he collected from my tool shed. We didn't have any holy water. Where do you even get it? Off the internet? We positioned ourselves on either side of the door to Wexler's third-floor apartment. I set down the stereo, facing its speakers toward the closed door. John unzipped the satchel and pulled out the weapon he had made. A Bible wrapped around the end of a baseball bat with electrician's tape. He brought it up to the ready. I pushed play. The smooth yet screechy sound of Cinderella's "Don't Know What You've Got Till It's Gone" filled the hall. We let it play for the duration of the song, one guy down the hall poking his head out of a door in confusion, and then closing it quickly at the sight of John and his bat. Wexler's door remained closed. We shut off the stereo, listened. Nothing from either side of the door. I tried the knob. Unlocked. I gestured to John, and he ducked inside, Bible bat at the ready. My gesture had meant, wait, we should reconsider this. I followed John in, reluctantly. I left the door open behind me, wide open. Lights on, but nobody home. The television was on, and I jumped when I saw it was me and John on the screen. Then I noticed a tripod and camcorder facing us from across the room, aimed at the sofa in front of us. It was apparently positioned to tape whoever was sitting there, the TV set to show the live feed. The sofa was empty now. We split up and quickly searched all five rooms of the small apartment, but the place had an empty feeling to it, and my heart had slowed down by the time I peered in the last doorway. Nobody here. The place was neat but cramped. Furniture too close to the TV, a kitchen table that would have to be pulled away from the wall if you wanted to seat more than two people, movie posters in the bedroom, bachelor pad. "Dave! In here!" I ran. I found John lying prone on the floor of the bedroom. "John! What?" At the sight of me, he sat up and thrust both hands out. In one hand, he held up a large folded envelope, ragged where it had been torn open. In the other hand, he held a small, silver canister. Just like mine. He said, "Under the bed." I let out a long breath and said, "Oh, holy mother of fuck." "Yeah." I sat on the bed. I shook my head slowly and said, "Man, we can't go through this again." "Look." He gave me the envelope. I flattened it out, saw the address was written in an aggressive, jagged scrawl that had to be a man's. "Attention. Kathy Bortz, reporter, Channel 5 Newsroom," and then the P.O. box number of the TV station. John said he remembered her from the newscast earlier, said she was the lead reporter who did the nursing home story. So if you were a citizen and had something big to share with the world, such as a vial of black oily goo from Planet X, you'd mail it to a Kathy Bortz. Or at least, that's what James Big Jim Sullivan would do. I can say that because his name was scrawled in the return address corner, followed by an address I had seen many times and had long memorized, always following the words, "I'm Molly. Please return me to..." I rubbed my hand over my mouth, tried to think it through. I said, "Jim had the soy sauce." John shrugged. "I guess so. Why didn't he tell us?"
for the same reason you haven't told anybody else. That night, I was surprised Jim hung around as long as he did, even after the needle came out. But maybe he was there because he did know what it was, trying to control the situation. And he did try to tell somebody, you know. He mailed it to the damn TV station.
Before he died. A shrug.
Probably.
Son of a bitch. I knew he knew more than he was letting on. We should have sweated him down and got some answers.
So he got it from the Jamaican?
I guess. Where'd the Jamaican get it from?
The Whig monsters, right?
What? You think Robert Marley had a ranch full of them somewhere?
No.
I think saying soy sauce comes from those monsters is like saying Pringles come from Pringles tubes. The sauce has a mind of its own. Those things are just carriers. And these little silver vials that keep turning up. You don't buy these at the hardware store, no. Somebody was supplying Robert. I found myself about to suggest calling Drake the cop, but I stopped that in mid-thought. I pictured all sorts of questions about the Las Vegas trip and the missing detective and so on. Then I thought again about calling Marconi, but that felt hopeless. John had looked up a number for his office, but it wasn't like that was a red phone that rang at his bedside. We'd get some voicemail tree asking if we wanted to order a copy of his DVD. I wandered into the living room and sat on the couch, seeing myself do it on the TV screen at the same time. I waved to myself. I looked depressed, rumpled and tired enough to sleep on a sidewalk. People would stop and put change in a cup for me. John went and did something in the kitchen, banging around plates and opening drawers. A minute later, he sat down beside me, carrying a sandwich and a soda. I noticed a VCR atop the TV was recording the camera's feed. I hit stop on the VCR and then rewind. John reached over to an answering machine on the end table. He skipped through 11 worthless messages before we heard the unmistakable voice of action weather watcher Ken Philippe.
Beep.
Danny, it's Ken. Call me, buddy. What you saw. I don't want you to misunderstand. Chrissy and I, we've been neighbors a long time. I knew her mom from way back. Look, I want you to know that she and I were talking, but we were talking about you, Danny. You got her scared, the way you've been acting. Anyway, give me a call, Danny, and I'll be over with a six-pack and we'll shoot the shit. I hope you're well, buddy.
Beep.
I started the VCR from the beginning of the tape. Empty sofa. Then Danny Wexler leaned into the frame, glancing over at the feed on the TV. He sat down, looking worn and beaten and drained, in a sweat-stained T-shirt and jeans. The door we had just entered through was visible over his shoulder. He said,
"Hi, honey. Are you there? Answer me if you're there."
I looked at John. Was he talking to somebody behind the camera? John didn't answer, just squinted quizzically as Wexler continued.
"Come on. It's okay."
A pause. Wexler staring into the camera in silence for a few seconds.
"Just say hello."
Another pause.
"I know, it's been a rough couple of weeks. Baby, I've done something really stupid. I've gotten wrapped up in something. Something you can't imagine."
"That's bizarre," said John. "It's like listening to one half of a phone conversation." "If I told you the details, you would wish I hadn't," he said. "But you know by now that I'm not myself. I come and go. And right now I'm fine, but I have to fight for every second of control. It's draining. Baby, it takes so much energy to keep myself on top, on the surface, at the wheel. As soon as I relax, he'll take over. It will take over. And I'll just be a spectator. Helpless." He broke down into sobs. Wexler babbled on, those long pauses here and there. I said, "So he was on the sauce, right?"
"At some point, yeah. Maybe he thought it would improve his sports cast. And now that I think about it, it sort of did.
Or maybe he didn't take it. Maybe it took him. The same way it happened to me. The reporter lady gets the envelope, she glances at it and assumes it's from a crazy person. She tosses it in the trash." John picked it up.
"Then Wexler's dumbass wanders along, gets curious and says, 'What's this?' and fishes it out. Horror ensues."
Fast forward toward the end of the tape. "See if he mentions where he's going before he leaves." John never got the chance. On the screen, Wexler flinched and looked up. The sound of Cinderella's "Don't know what you've got till it's gone" filled the room. Wexler jumped off the couch and walked out of the frame. A couple of minutes later, we watched ourselves burst through the door. John and I leapt up from the couch as if our asses were spring-loaded.
"We just missed him!" John screamed. "We just missed him! Shit!"
On the TV, John and I walked past the camera, then headed off to search the apartment. On screen, a shape appeared above us. Some kind of creature clinging to the ceiling. Wexler. On the screen, he scrambled upside down to the doorway, clutching the top of the doorframe and pushing himself into the hall. Weightless. Moving fast as a salamander, an inhuman blur. John hoisted the ghetto blaster, punched play. "Sweet Child of Mine" blasted. He held the stereo over his head like John Cusack in Say Anything, and charged into the hall. We pounded down the stairs, power ballad in our wake, stupidly hoping Wexler had hung around the building. In the parking lot, a minute later, John spun with the ghetto blaster, warding off the night. No sign of Wexler. The parking lot was empty. The song ended and we stood there like idiots, chests heaving, chilled air frosting the sweat on my face. John said, "Maybe he went back to the TV station." I shrugged. "Or to Ken's house, or Chrissy's house, or the hospital, or that 24-hour tattoo place, or the airport where he has a flight waiting to take him to Thailand. You know where I think we should check first? The nearest all-night bakery." We trudged around the building and back through the rows of hedges that separated the visitor's lot from the reserved spaces. Black as pitch out here. I glanced up and noticed the lights were off in the lot. Of course they are. And there was no moon. Dark as hell. It was chilly. That wet autumn night kind of cold. But I knew part of the cold I was feeling was coming from inside. Fear was creeping up on me, working from the guts out. "Just go back, man. Go back home to the warmth and the light. You did your best. Now it's over. You won't find him. And dark like this, true dark, belongs to bats and rapists. You did what you could." I walked on, feeling already like this was wrong, totally wrong, my car keys clutched in my hand like a rosary, our shoes crunching dead leaves with each step. Crunch, crunch, crunch. I blinked, trying to adjust to the dark, failing. Eyes watering from the chilled air, a little soreness in my knees from bouncing down the steps, a tickling around the hairs of my ankles, every nerve alive and standing at attention. I blinked and could see a little now, my Hyundai just 20 feet away, one of two cars in the lot. The low, cloud-filtered gloom made the blue compact appear a few shades too dark. I suddenly had this flash of visual memory, the glimpse of parking lot as my headlights swept across it when we pulled in. Flat asphalt under circles of lamplight. That memory knotted in my gut for some reason, something I couldn't put my finger on. We walked. Crunch. Cranch. Cringe. Something's wrong. Seeing it again, the lights flashing across the lot as we turned in. A newly paved lot with fresh, dark pavement against sharp yellow lines. Crunch. Crunch. And completely devoid of fallen leaves. Crunch. That tickling at my ankles again. I stopped, looked down. From behind me, John screamed. The ground was rippling, pulsing, as if pelted by a heavy rain. Twitching. Cockroaches. My legs were covered with them. I squealed and crazily slapped at my pant legs, trying to knock the things off me, dropping the duffel bag and my car keys in the process. If this was one of our patented hallucinations, it was a five-senses hallucination extravaganza. Once, while half asleep, I had a cockroach crawl across the back of my neck. It's quite the unique feeling and hard to mistake. This was real, quite real. So very tingly and itchingly real, and my heart was pounding, my skin crawling, and I mean literally crawling. In that instant, I was sure the insects were not only on my skin, but under it, burrowing through muscle tissue, spindly legs flicking over nerve bundles. Every thought was blown from my mind. You would think that under those conditions nothing would surprise me. You'd be wrong. I was quite surprised, for instance, when I looked down and saw that my fallen car keys were running away from me, floating, as if carried downstream. They're taking my keys! The roaches are stealing my car keys! I trotted toward the car, itching in 100 places. I saw then that it wasn't the autumn night that made the paint appear darker. It was the couple hundred thousand roaches swarming over the body. I took off my jacket and used it to sweep the bastards away from the door and window. I yanked open the latch, squishing a roach between my fingers and the handle as I did. I swung the door open. There were a lot more roaches on the inside than out. They had puddled in the floorboards, and they poured out onto the pavement like the jackpot from the devil's slot machine, the bugs raining down with a sound like frying bacon. There was a lump on the driver's seat, invisible under a rippling blanket of roaches. But then the lump grew and pulsed, and I realized the lump was roaches. They scrambled over one another, twitching legs, entangling and knotting, piling higher and higher. You see people in horror movies standing there stupidly while some special effect takes shape before them? The dumbass is gawking at it instead of turning and running like the wind. And I wanted to run, to do the smart thing. But this was my car, damn it, my only car. I'd be damned if I was going to walk to work every day. The roach pile in the seat grew and grew, until it was a grotesque, lumpy column, 2 feet high. Bugs were pouring around my shoes like floodwater, flowing up the tires and across the fenders and into the driver's seat. Their stampede made a soft sound like someone crunching cereal from across the room, and I could smell the things, an odor like an old fryer full of dirty cooking oil. In the seat, two smaller columns jutted from the base of the bug pile like tree roots, hanging off the front of the seat, building down toward the floorboard. The lump now had legs. They were, I saw, forming themselves into a human figure.
Hey, why not?
Arms formed a few seconds later. Finally, a head. A full replica of a man, sculpted entirely from cockroaches, now sat comfortably in the driver's seat. The compacted ball of roaches that was its skull rotated toward me, as if it had turned to look me in the eye. It spoke.
A cockroach has no soul, yet it runs and eats and shits and fucks and breeds. It has no soul, yet it lives a full life, just like you.
Time froze. I was locked in this moment with this thing. I spoke, but I don't think my mouth ever moved. I said, or thought, "Who are you?"
Who are you? Who are you to one like Korok, who fills his belly with great men, swallowing them as a whale swallows swarms of krill? The desires and ambitions of men who towered over you are, in Korok, digested over eternities, fermenting into an anguish that exceeds the sum of all living mankind suffering through the ages. Populations of worlds roil in his guts, the mad screams and desperate longings of 7 trillion souls escape every time Korok farts. And he does fart. So let me repeat my question. Who are you, you shit-spewing crotch fruit?
I'm nobody, I found myself saying. I'm nobody. Why not just leave me be? I have nothing you can take.
Korok enjoys bitter food, and he has decided to let you rest on his tongue. Then he will swallow. You wish to be left alone. You will get that wish. You will die alone, with shit in your pants. That is a prophecy.
I blinked and realized that the time standing still wasn't an illusion. No time had actually passed. The whole conversation was relayed directly to me via a conduit the soy sauce granted me all those months ago. The roach man raised its hand. My car keys. It started the Hyundai. Its other arm clasped the open door with fingers of knotted insects, then pulled it shut. The roach man shifted into reverse, backed out of the space, and drove to the parking lot exit. It signaled a right turn, then drove off into the night. I looked down and saw the lot was now clean of insect life. John threw away his cigarette and said,
"Shit! I knew that was gonna happen."
Shakily I said, "What now?"
"You okay?"
It spoke to me, I think.
"What'd it say?"
"Just, I don't know."
"Man, how are you gonna report this to your insurance company?"
We heard an engine from behind us, a white Ford Focus rolling into the parking lot. Out the side window popped the pretty head of Chrissy, the girl from the couch at the crime scene. I stepped closer and saw that, yes, her body was attached.
Hey, I'm glad I caught you guys. Did you see that newscast?
John trotted up, carrying his satchel.
Yes, Wexler's gone. We need your car.
What? Why?
John circled around to the passenger side door and said,
Car chase.
She smiled.
Cool. Hop in.
Wait, I said, digging up my roll of testaments. Here, eat one of these.
And who are you again?
She asked. I'm the only man here who has his head on straight. This ain't a situation for the dog catcher anymore. There's something else. Something dark. We're talking every bad thing you ever thought didn't exist. Demons and witchcraft and gremlins and Sasquatch. And I don't care if you believe or...
all right, stop talking. I know what I saw tonight.
She reached into her sweatshirt and pulled out a gold cross dangling on a thin chain.
See?
Could I wear this if I were some kind of devil or vampire or something?
Now, are you getting in or not?
I studied her as best I could, judged her on the spot. I got in the car. The tires chirped as she pulled out of the parking lot, turning the same direction Roachman had gone. Traffic was dead at this hour, and we hummed along with the speedometer hovering just above the 75 mark.
So freaking dark. No moon and no stars, and we're all on our own down here.
There, said John.
Taillights, way up ahead, small and close together. It was my boy, all right. It was at this moment I realized we, again, had no plan for what to do once we caught up to it. The same thing apparently occurred to Chrissy, who asked,
What do we do now?
Get up alongside, said John, and then ram it off the road.
I'm not doing that. Who's going to pay for the...
She cut off her words with a scream. We were close now, close enough for her to see the driver.
What is that thing?
You don't want to know, John said.
But don't be afraid. Get up close again.
I got a plan.
She looked confused, but faced forward and pressed the focus up to 80. We ran up alongside the blue compact.
Keep us even, John said as he rolled down the window.
Roachman had his window down too, one roachy elbow resting outside the window like a trucker. The occasional roach dripped off his arm like candle wax, flicking off into the wind. John started to climb out the window, wind whipping his hair around his face, and I had the crazy idea that he was going to try to fling himself over to the other car like Bruce Willis. Instead, he leaned his torso back against the car and braced his knees against the inside of the door. He unzipped his pants. Roachman turned his roach head toward us just in time to take a windblown spray of urine to the face. The creature flailed and convulsed. The Hyundai wobbled in its lane. The little tires lost traction, and the car went soaring off the side of the road. It plowed through weeds and tipped nose down over an embankment, landing in a culvert with a white explosion of water. Chrissy pulled over, and we all spilled out.
What was that, huh?
I screamed at John.
What the hell was that?
Hey, we stopped him. The goal was to get the car back, my car, intact, and not splattered with urine.
Look, aw, man!
A dark shape, floating up from the Hyundai, a black plume of smoke, with two glowing eyes. I felt it. It was as if the Shadow Man had reached out to me, cold fingers running through my skull and down my spine. Then, it was gone, slipping soundlessly off into the night. I heard a breathy sound from Chrissy. She had slapped a hand over her mouth, eyes wide. John said,
They're here, Dave. They're here, they're here, they're here. They're here. Shit!
I hissed.
What are they?
Don't know. It's probably in Marconi's book, but I can never finish it. It gets so slow after the first two chapters.
To Chrissy, I said, Don't worry, it looks like it left.
You saw it.
She shook her head.
I felt it. It just ran through me, this sort of heavy feeling like there was nothing there. Like everything was nothing, everything everywhere. There's like molecules and stuff, but behind it, nothing, just cold and dark.
She fell into silence. I said to John, When it spoke to me, it mentioned Korok, just like Molly.
Was that thing Korok?
No. I'm sure of that. Chrissy wasn't following this conversation at all, and instead focused her attention down toward the crashed Hyundai, two-thirds submerged in the standing water, its rear stuck into the air like the Titanic.
Ew, what's that?
A layer of cockroaches, 2 inches thick, floated out from around the car like an oil slick, clumps here and there still holding the shape of limbs. A half dozen old fast food bags floated up from the interior and hung nearby like buoys. Roaches, I said. You can see them?
Yeah. Where'd they come from?
My car was really dirty. I turned to John. What the shadow guy here did with the bugs? I think he did the same thing to Molly, just reached out and took over. John said,
and Wexler, too, I guess. So they can do that. This is indescribably bad.
What now? Chrissy asked.
Are they, like, demons?
Well, they're evil, said John. You just saw one of them steal a car.
Molly!
Chrissy, pointing down the road. Sure enough, the dog that was standing about 20 yards away, it was either Molly or an exact replica. To me, John said,
ghost?
Chrissy can see her.
Zombie, then. Well, she's earthbound, that's a positive sign.
Molly barked, trotted off down the road, then turned and barked again. John said to Chrissy,
she wants us to follow her.
He said it to her, not to me, leaving me out of the decision, asshole. I glanced at my watch. Anybody want to go to Denny's? Maybe this thing will sort itself out. They both went to the car. I started listing all of the things that were retarded about this plan, and by the time I reached the end, we were all rolling down the street with a copper dog in our headlights. After a few minutes, the dog, looking perfectly happy despite having exploded in half earlier that evening, turned and bounded off the road. She streaked across an expanse of weeds, gravel, and busted concrete. We were at the Mall of the Dead. That's what we called the half-finished and subsequently abandoned undisclosed shopping center. The city sank $40 million worth of tax breaks and infrastructure into getting the thing built before 3 of the 5 investors disappeared. I always imagined that all 3 simultaneously shot each other, like in the movie Reservoir Dogs. Now, 3 years and 30 lawsuits later, raccoons nested in the 150 empty store slots, and rainwater puddled in the halls. It lay there in the darkness, broken and rotting like a decomposing animal carcass that was slowly picked apart by scavengers. Molly zipped off toward the building and was swallowed by the darkness. Chrissy said,
do we follow her in there?
The radio kicked on, mandolin plucking the intro to an early 90s song by R.E.M. called Losing My Religion. John and I reacted, Chrissy didn't. It only took a few seconds for me to realize this was not the song as Michael Stipe had written it. Ooh, knife plus nigger equals you, and Jews are dead meat.
I know people around here, John said, who would like the song better that way.
You can hear it?
Yeah.
Chrissy said,
hear what?
Never mind. Look, over by those dumpsters, John said. Wexler's car. 5 SPRTS. Well, I said. Nothing to do now but wander the fuck around that abandoned building, totally unarmed. John opened the satchel and drew out a long metal flashlight, clicked on the beam to confirm that it still worked. Then he pulled out a wadded-up hand towel and handed it to me. I unwrapped it and found myself holding the stainless steel automatic pistol I had stolen from the pickup during the Las Vegas thing. I had planned to ditch it, to throw it into the river or something. Not only was the weapon stolen, but for all I knew, it had been used to hold up 4 liquor stores and shoot 2 policemen before I got hold of it.
Why do you still have this? I thought you were going to make it disappear.
John shrugged.
Never got around to it. I keep it hidden. And I scratched off the serial numbers there. Should be safe.
I ejected the magazine.
What? Why is it loaded?
Oh, Head bought bullets for it. He borrowed it a month ago. I think he had to threaten a dude with it.
He brought it right back, though.
Chrissy said,
you're not going to shoot Danny, are you? If he's possessed or whatever, you know that's not his fault.
You belong to a church, right? I asked. You know anything about performing exorcisms, that sort of thing? She shook her head.
You know your Bible? John asked. You could show us the part that's got the spells and incantations and stuff and read them right from there.
She just stared at him. She heard the chorus as the bastardized song continued. Chorus now.
That's me in the porno. That's me in the spotlight, losing my religion, trying to beat a tight-ass Jew.
Chrissy dug into her purse and pulled out a little black plastic thing that I thought was a flashlight, but when she pressed the button, a blue spark jumped across the end.
It's a taser. Stun gun. I don't think I've got anything else in here. She sifted around in the purse. Nail file?
No. Let's go.
Our hearts hammering, the three of us approached the sprawling building, none of us making a sound other than the crunching of gravel under our shoes. I made my way to Wexler's car, edged toward the window with the gun. Nobody inside. Ahead was the tall, rusted metal framework that I supposed was going to be a fancy awning for the main entrance. Beneath it was a row of huge windows and a bank of doors, all boarded over with plywood. Among the graffiti, something had been painted in bold letters 2 feet high. On closer inspection, we saw the letters were twitching, moving, ever so slightly. Slugs. A couple hundred of them had slimed their way up the boards to spell out a phrase that I was certain was right from Korok, whoever he was. Y-O-U-R, doomed. His spelling, not mine. One panel of plywood had been pulled partially off its frame, presumably by Mr. Wexler. John said,
"Dave, you got the gun. You should go in first."
"You got the stereo. Besides, if I go in and get killed right off the bat, you're all fucked. But if you get attacked, I can rescue you with the gun."
"Maybe Chrissy should go, like as a decoy."
She moved toward the opening, but I shouldered her aside. The stink hit me 1 foot inside the place. Rot and mildew and dead rodents. The empty storefronts were boarded up, giving us a single impossibly long corridor. The floor was littered with paper cups and candy wrappers and cigarette butts and other teenage droppings. I saw a used condom under my shoe. Our only light was from a huge skylight running down the length of the building. Parts of it had been boarded over. Other sections were spiderwebbed with breaks and clouded with mounds of accumulated dead leaves. When we walked under the boarded-over sections of the glass, we found ourselves in pools of absolute blackness. John lit the flashlight. He fired up the stereo. "Home, Sweet Home" by Motley Crue. We plunged ahead, a creeping pool of light and music in the dead space. A sound. Shoes scraping on floor tile. I raised the gun. "Wexler?" No answer. We reached a bend in the mall, the hall taking a 90-degree turn to the right. Blood was pumping in my ears. Palm sweat greased the handle of the gun. Ahead of us, shoes scraping tile. A shadowy shape. Not shoes. Hooves. Moving fast. It was as tall as a man. It passed into a shaft of moonlight. John screamed a profanity. I squeezed the trigger. Gunshots hammered the air. Chrissy shrieked. Yellow flashes from the gun barrel. Glimpses of brown fur and antlers in the darkness. A deer? Maybe it had been one, once. This creature had grown several new sets of eyes. Each of its antlers ended in a snapping set of lobsterish claws. It looked like it had a novelty chandelier from a seafood restaurant on its head. Looking back, I have to say it was the stupidest-looking thing I have ever seen. It stumbled as it got close, and my wild shot started to land. Blossoms of red opening up on the beast's chest and neck. It tried to turn away, showing me its ribcage and taking several broadside shots for its trouble. The mutated deer collapsed, thrashing on the dirty floor tiles and leaving red smears like a child's finger painting. It twitched one last time and was still. My hands were shaking. The gun looked broken, the top half of it pushed an inch from the rest of the mechanism. After fiddling with it for a few minutes, I realized that this is what the gun naturally did when it was empty. I pushed in the button to release the empty magazine. Great job conserving ammo so far. We approached the fallen Wuzzadeer, kicking brass casings as we went. I pushed at its furry hide with my foot. As solid as a dead deer, I turned to Chrissy, asked, "You see it?" She nodded, eyes still wide.
"Oh, look," yelped John. "Look at its ass."
The deer's ass was melting, puddling on the floor like candle wax. In less than a minute, the entire hindquarters were a brown pool on the floor, the ribs quickly caving in like a punctured balloon at a Thanksgiving Day parade. As the front legs and head flattened, the liquid residue from the hindquarters dissolved before our eyes, leaving dry floor behind. There was one part that didn't melt. A section in the middle of the animal that protruded from the pink and brown slime. Square. A box. About 6 inches to a side. I scooted it away with my foot. Heavy. When the goo dissolved from it, I saw that it was a green and yellow box marked "Shotgun Shells," John said. "Too bad we don't have a..." His voice trailed off as his gaze shifted to a lone wooden crate over by the wall, presumably full of floor tile or coils of electrical wiring and other mall fixins. John delivered a series of hard kicks to the side of the crate, cracking and splintering the boards. He plunged his hands into the opening and pulled out a dark length of plastic and metal that I had already guessed was a shotgun. Growls emerged from the darkness, followed by the scratches of claws. Many claws. I clenched the empty gun in my hand, pointing it stupidly into the darkness. John frantically loaded the shotgun.
"Whoa, look at the time," said Arnie, starting to leave. "Mr. Wong, it's been a hell of a lot of fun talking to you. But I should start my drive back. I got 6 hours ahead of me. The piece may not run next month, but soon. They may want to run it on Halloween, you know?"
"Arnie, please, you came all this way. Don't walk away thinking what you're thinking." He dug his car keys from his pocket.
"I'm not here to judge. I said that already. The shotgun, hey, the roofers could have left that behind. And maybe the deer got fed up with the local hunters and ate one of them, including the shotgun shells the poor guy had in his pocket."
He pulled out a cigar from an inside pocket and jammed it into his mouth. "No, it's nothing like that. The thing in Wexler, it had the power to call up on these things, I guess, to try to kill us. But I think Wexler was still inside there, too. And he was working from the other end, helping us out. He was on the sauce, you know, and he used it.
After you told me the part about Las Vegas, you know how I said it was the stupidest story I had ever heard?
You didn't say that."
"Well, I was thinking it. But I've decided I owe that Las Vegas story an apology, because this last thing made that one look like the grapes of wrath. I'll see you around."
Arnie walked toward the exit. I followed, stopping quickly to pay the lady at the counter. "Wait," I stammered as he pushed through the door. "I got, you know, all that paperwork on the Hyundai and the accident and all that. The insurance company? They took pictures of the scene and, well, you can't really see anything, but they described the scene in the report, the dead roaches and all that. I went back that next morning and I got a hand, a clump of the bugs in the shape of the fingers. I got it at home."
Nothing from Arnie. He didn't even nod.
"In my tool shed, in a jar. I can show it to you. I mean, what kind of a person would fake that, would sit at home and glue a bunch of roaches together? Honey, what are you doing?" "Oh, I'm making a roach hand, you know, to aid my credibility with the press."
Arnie said, "The kid you say you killed during the Las Vegas thing, Fred Chu? Say I go looking into that, his disappearance."
I hesitated. "Do it. Those records are out there. I've been honest with you. I keep saying that."
"So you admit killing him?"
"Off the record?"
"Yeah." "And the other kid that died, Big Jim, he's really dead too. You can look it up."
"I already did."
"But Big Jim, he would have gone to the cops about Fred, wouldn't he? That you shot Fred? He didn't seem too happy about it."
I don't know. We'll never know."
"Worked out pretty good for you that Big Jim died then, didn't it? Fuck you. Don't you see you got all this ridiculous shit swirling around in your story, Wong? But then you got the parts that are real, the parts that can be verified. And they're all felonies. A dead kid, a missing cop. So why don't I do both of us a favor and pretend we never talked, because I'm not sure I want to hear the rest of it."
He unlocked the door to a white Cavalier and ducked inside.
"Wait!"
I jogged up to the car and circled around to the passenger side. I gently smacked the window with my palm. Arnie hesitated, then reached over and unlocked it. I leaned in. "Can I sit down?" He paused once more, not wanting to prolong this, but not quite sure how to get rid of me. Maybe he was afraid I was dangerous, liable to fly into crazy man violence if turned away. He used both hands to scoop up a bundle of notebooks and folders from the passenger seat. I ducked in and arranged my feet around a pile of recording equipment and cassettes on the floorboard. "Here," I said. "Look." I pulled a single folded sheet of paper from my pocket. "It's been in my pants all day, so it's kind of wrinkled and, moist. But read it. I copied that from Dr. Marconi's book. Science and the Beyond, Dr. Albert Marconi, page 192. leaving it looking like a jar of pickled eggs that had been eaten and then vomited by a gorilla. The strange ritual was done in service to a deity who, to my ears, sounded like Kodok. The tribe had no written language. I was told that each member bore the mark of this god, and I was allowed to witness the branding ceremony each member undertakes at the age of manhood. The young man was forced to lay face down on a mat, naked. The priest then brought out a clay jar containing the writhing maggots of botflies. The larvae were placed on the back of the young man, arranged in the shape of Kodok's symbol. The maggots then chewed through the top layer of skin, digging holes a half inch deep. I was told the larvae would, according to ceremony, be allowed to remain in their warm, wet tunnels in the young man's back for 7 days. If the young man succumbed to the itch and scratched the spot, he would fail the test of manhood and would have to wait a year before attempting it again. On the 7th day, the larvae are extracted by the priest and the wound treated. What remains will be the trails of scar tissue, following the paths eaten by the worms. These scars would form the brand of Kodok. The priest showed me the finished symbol, and the pipe literally fell from my mouth. Once more, it was like the symbol for Pi, only rotated 90 degrees to the left. The same symbol I had seen a Manchester toddler draw in his trance state months before. As soon as I got back to Lima, I phoned Dr. Haleen, the Egyptologist. Shouting to each other over a poor connection, he described for me again the hieroglyph he had discovered in his dig, nearly 7,500 miles from where I stood. I was so stunned by what he told me that I could not keep my feet. Sitting on the floor of my hotel, I pondered the enormity of the revelation and sought out my flask. Haleen explained that there was an Egyptian god named Kuk, who was already known to Egyptologists. In the Ogdoad cosmogony, Kuk was a frog-like god who represented darkness and chaos. Haleen, however, believed he had stumbled upon a cult that worshipped his rash and destructive son, Korak. This god was represented symbolically by a man punctured by 2 spears, one in the mouth and one in the groin, the twin centers of desire for mankind. In the cult's mythology, Korak was a reckless and cruel slave master who used men's bodily desires to lure them to their destruction for his own amusement. Dr. Haleen's hieroglyph and the symbol of Kodok I had copied in my notepad when laying over one another were nearly identical in shape. Here we had now 3 peoples living on opposite corners of the planet, separated by oceans of water and time, independently identifying the same deity. It was the single best piece of evidence for the supernatural ever discovered by science. Another day of travel took me back to the village. I arrived in such a state of excitement that the priest had me restrained by several strong men and forced me to drink a potion to cool the embers in my head. After some time, I got alone with the priest and asked him about Kodok and the symbol. The symbol, he told me, was a representation of the god Kodok himself. Kodok was a young god, he told me, hot-headed and prone to fits of rage if not pleased. The vertical line was his body. The top horizontal line was a stream of vomit, the second horizontal line was a stream of urine. For, you see, the tribe believed Kodok liked to drink to excess, and when he was intoxicated he interfered with the affairs of man and caused great destruction. This was the tribe's explanation for all the suffering and misfortune in the world. Arnie skimmed over it, then let out a long sigh. See? That's Korak. That symbol, that's what was on Molly's foot. It's what's on... Look, you're a journalist. There are independent sources here confirming the same thing. It doesn't matter if it's crazy. This is evidence, right?
What am I supposed to say, Wong? What do you want from me?
I need somebody to know about this. I have to get this out before...
I shook my head. I ran out of words.
Before what? A monster catches you in an alley and eats you.
Tell him about Amy.
No. It's nothing like that. Well, I mean, that's a possibility, but it's bigger than that.
Arnie let out a sigh.
Just listen, I said, begging a little. Just listen a little bit longer, and then everything will be clear. You'll understand how much is at stake here. Seriously.
Arnie sighed and looked off across the parking lot.
I ain't got much time, Wong. It's getting late.
I know, just...
I need you to drive somewhere. We go there. And I can show you. Everything will be clear.
You'll know what's true and what isn't.
Where?
The mall. The mall.
He gave me a long, hard look. He was probably sizing up his ability to take me down if I went nuts on him and tried to bite through his neck. He apparently judged his physical prowess to be superior because he twisted the key and revved the engine to life. Turn right out of the parking lot here.
The skittering footsteps grew louder in the mall's cavernous hallway. John pumped the shotgun and raised it.
Sister Christian by Night Ranger slowed, garbled, ground to silence. The last of the juice in the ghetto blaster's batteries. Scratching claws, approaching fast. Two gray blurs. They were coyotes. Muscular, with matted fur and red eyes. They both skidded to a stop at the sight of us. Both took in deep breaths and breathed plumes of fire. The three of us dove behind the crate. John leaned over with the shotgun, fired, and tore a fist-sized chunk out of the first coyote head. He fired at the second one, missed, pumped, fired, missed again. The beast lunged at me, knocking me over like a linebacker. It stood on my chest, its breath smelling like burnt electrical wires. It sucked in a huge breath that I knew would take the flesh off my skull. A hand shot out, punching into the coyote's side. Chrissy hit the taser. Blue sparks flew. The coyote's abdomen, swollen with flammable breath, exploded like the Hindenburg. Furry chunks hit me in the face, a beautiful orange fireball rolling up toward the glass ceiling. I scrambled to my feet, my face hot and tight, brushing slimy red chunks of animal off me and cursing. I wasn't sure if it was coyote blood or my own piss on my pants. Something heavy bounced off my shoe. John shone the flashlight, revealing a box of bullets. Laying next to it was a key with the number 1 etched into it.
A key, said John, flicking shells into his shotgun.
Good. Now, if I know what's going on here, and I think I do, we'll have to wander around looking for that door. Behind it, we'll meet a series of monsters, or, more likely, a whole bunch of the same one. We'll kill them, get another key, and then it'll open a really big door. Now, right before that, we'll probably get nicer guns. It may require us to backtrack some, and it might get really tedious and annoying.
Oh, fuck you, I said. I'm staying here.
I sat on the ground, pulled open the box of bullets, and tried to put one in the pistol. It fit. Hey, why the hell not? I started pushing rounds into the pistol magazine one at a time.
You go find the door.
A metallic thunder filled the hall. We all flew into action, bullets spilling off my lap and rolling in every direction. Ahead of us, something huge dropped from the ceiling, blocking our view. The clanking roar finally ended in a crash that made all three of us jump. We advanced, guns drawn. It was one of those enormous drop-down gates that malls use to button up at closing time.
Well, Chrissy said, I guess this is the big door. There's a keyhole at the bottom near the latch.
All right, said John, nodding. All right. Big door, sooner than I expected, but whatever. Now that means there's a boss behind there, a huge bad guy. He focused on Chrissy. I want you to be prepared for this. This evil that has Wexler, it's impossible for us to imagine what form it's taken with him. Expect tentacles and a whole bunch of eyes, or just one eye.
I don't know what exactly to expect, but I know it'll be a way bigger asshole than we faced out here.
Chrissy! From behind us. We spun on the voice, and I involuntarily squeezed the trigger. The gun clicked. I hadn't chambered around. It was Wexler, trudging up in the shadows behind us. He looked pale, but perfectly human.
I posed casually with the gun, so as not to be too blatant about the fact that I had almost killed him with it just now.
Chrissy moved toward him.
Don't, he said. Stay away from me. He'll be back any second now. He'll be back.
He bent over and broke down in a coughing fit. Blood splattered on the floor.
Dude, said John. Let's get you to a hospital. We'll protect you and...
No. Listen. I'm falling apart. I'm falling apart inside. When he comes back, I won't hold up. Now, how much do you know about this place?
If you're talking about this town in general, John said,
don't even get us started. We're the experts.
No. I'm talking about the doors. This building.
Coughing fit.
The doors, under it, or somewhere. I don't know where. Hidden. This building, and others, I think.
We can go over all that later, I said. Where's the shadow man? The thing. The one who's possessing you. Where is he now? Is he behind the gate?
He'll come back here. Let him. Let him enter me.
Then kill me. Chrissy screamed.
No! Danny!
Kill me and burn my body. Then burn this place down on top of me. Find the other doors if there are more and burn them down, too. In fact, just burn the whole town, just to be safe.
Doors?
I don't get... Danny coughed, spat, then coughed and coughed some more, hacking until he finally passed out. Chrissy ran to him, but couldn't get him to respond. He was still breathing, though, so we dragged him over to the wall, leaning him against it. John and I trained our guns on him, and waited. Chrissy looked back and forth at us and said,
"What are you guys doing?"
John and I glanced at each other.
"Well, you know," I said meekly, "we're waiting for the thing to come back into him so we can,
"We are not doing that." To me, the guy looked to be on his last legs anyway, so this really did seem like a more reasonable plan than getting eaten by whatever monstrosity waited behind that gate.
Shouldn't we honor his final wishes?
We were unable to convince Chrissy of this. She took the key and started working at the lock of the huge gate. I sighed and went to her, the pistol clasped in both hands. John nudged her aside and knelt with his hand on the gate handle. Chrissy pulled the taser from her pocket. John looked up at us and said,
"We stay together. Look for a weak spot, like an eye or something. If there are crates around the room, cover me, and I'll open them. See if there's a rocket launcher or something in one of them. If either of you find a big green polka-dotted mushroom, set it aside. We may need it later."
The blood pounding through my ears again, my skull sounding like the inside of a seashell. I blinked hard to try to clear the spots pulsing in front of my eyes. I knew this was the thing to do, but every fiber screamed to retreat and try again some other day, when we had more on our side, when I wasn't so tired, or so nervous, or so fat. I struggled for something to cling to, the way soldiers in foxholes picture their families or a flag. My car, I thought crazily. This fucker crashed the Wongmobile, and for that, he must taste death. It would have to do. I reminded myself to breathe. John pulled up the gate, rolling it up on its tracks with a sound like tank treads. We entered a huge octagon of a room, more storefront blanks where food counters were to go. There was some broken glass and dead leaves on the ground, where one of the panes in the overhead skylight had broken out. Nothing else. John gestured to our left and said, "Check it out." It wasn't a monster, but still I stopped in my tracks, let out a long breath and said, "Shit." There was a painting on one wall to our left. On the wall, on the ceiling, on the floor, on the 2x4s stacked next to the wall. I recognized the style. The painting was abstract, yet strangely realistic. It was a three-dimensional picture of a ring intersecting another ring in a way that seemed to shift as you looked at it. Like the landscape I saw in Robert Marley's bedroom, it seemed to draw you in, to take on complexity as you stared.
"It's a picture of time."
I tore my eyes off it and said to John, "I think your Jamaican friend was here."
"I think he was actually living here."
He nodded toward a nearby nest made up of an ancient sleeping bag and about half a dozen plastic milk crates. The surrounding floor looked like the aftermath of a bloody battle between empty Captain Morgan bottles and faded candy bar wrappers. I thought about Wexler, ranting about hidden doors. Now here was where our guy, our patient Zero, had set up camp all those months ago. I felt like there were dots that I was intentionally not connecting. I wanted to go somewhere warm and bright to think about all this. Or, even better, not. I wandered out to the center of the floor, crunching glass and leaves underfoot. John lit up a cigarette and said,
"Man, if you could flood this place in the winter and let it freeze up, you'd have a kick-ass place to play hockey."
A shriek from behind me. Chrissy, screeching my name. A shotgun blast split through the air. I spun, scanning the room through the sights of the automatic. John screamed my name, bellowing instructions I couldn't make out. Then I saw it, the black shape zipping through the air, like a hefty bag blown around in a hurricane. I spotted it, lost it, caught it again, then it vanished. I spun around. No sign of it. John and Chrissy were staring at me, horrified.
"It's okay. I'm okay. Where did it go?"
I was okay, now that I thought about it. felt great, in fact.
The adrenaline must have been working, because all the fear evaporated in an instant. A veil lifted from over my thoughts. John and Chrissy. 2 of 6 billion humans on the planet. 1 American, I heard, consumes enough calories to keep 40 African children alive.
John routinely burned 0.5 gallon of gasoline to get a pack of cigarettes. The girl bought special shampoo for her dog while Somali children starved. She warded off her guilt with a gold symbol around her neck, the intersecting strips of gold the last thing millions saw before their limbs were ripped from their bodies in medieval torture machines. 2 locusts, standing before me, blazing through resources by the ton. I had been such a fucking fool.
Dave?
John dragged me here for one reason. His attention span demanded new and loud experiences, links to add to his chain of distractions until the day he would finally drink himself to death.
And the girl?
I could save her life 12 times over in this room, and she would still climb into bed with the guy with the great eyes and the promising TV career. She could never contaminate her precious genetic material with mine. When was I going to stop letting the world bleed me dry?
Dave, can you hear me?
Without a word, I took a step toward the pair. I kicked something metal. It was a rusty utility knife, 1 inch of blade protruding from the end. I stuffed it in my pocket, thinking I would need it later. The gun aimed non-threateningly at the floor by my side. I strode toward the girl and was pleased to see a look of crippling fear ooze into her eyes, an expression that broke those sculpted porcelain features like a hammer. Have you ever been truly scared of anything, princess?
I had a second to look over Chrissy from the neck down, those perfect thigh muscles, soft curves under softer skin, the hint of perfect little breasts hiding under the sweatshirt. I suddenly had an idea for this girl that would win my dick the Nobel Prize.
Footsteps. John, running toward me. I spun, raised the gun, shot him in the head. He tumbled forward, spray of blood droplets arcing through the air as he fell face first onto the floor. I moved toward him, but put a 2nd and 3rd and 4th round into his brain. Movement behind me. Pop. Pop. Zzz, pop. 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 Pain. A crackling sound, like popcorn. Every muscle in my body first clenched, then went slack. The tiled floor rose up and smacked me in the face. I lay there, plywood pressed against my cheek, a bug's eye view of the world. I was paralyzed, my brain scrambled.
Looks like Chrissy needs new shoes. Hey, look, a smashed cigarette butt.
I felt the gun twist out of my fingers. With a huge effort, I turned my head enough to look up and see Chrissy holding the gun on me while she inspected John. He shifted and moved, sitting up. He took off his flannel shirt and pressed it against a wet wound on his scalp, his hair matted with blood. She helped him to his feet. They towered over me, Chrissy with the taser in her hand. I strained to move a limb. Random muscles started to flex under my command again, but I couldn't organize them. John, bloody rag pressed to his skull, looked me right in the eye.
David, if you're still you at all, you know why I'm doing this. Are you in there?
I met his gaze. I tried to talk, tested a few words to get my lips moving.
John? John, I understand, and I'm sorry. I don't know what came over me just now, really, but I'm thinking clear now. It's me. Don't let her shoot me, okay?
He studied my face. I grasped the situation with growing horror.
John, I said, eyes pleading.
Please.
All I needed was for him to turn his back. I had the utility knife. Just hide it in my hand, and with a quick and decisive move, I could slit his throat. Use him as a shield, get the pistol away from the girl. After that, then she'd do whatever I wanted under the barrel of a gun. Everything would be fine.
John took Chrissy aside. They whispered to each other while she kept the gun on me, the barrel tipping up and down in her delicate hand.
I tried to move my legs. I could feel them, but couldn't make them obey me. I ground my teeth so hard I felt like they would shatter.
Gotta stay cool.
I couldn't hear, but the girl was doing all the talking now, the bitch trying to convince John to do something. He finally agreed and came back to face me.
Dave, here's what I think. I think the thing that was in Wexler was in you. Maybe it still is, maybe it isn't. Now we're gonna do something here.
Chrissy's going to give me the gun, and I'm going to put it on you. It's nothing personal. And on top of that, she's going to press the zappy thing against your skin while she does this. So do not move. You know I won't kill you, Dave, but you jump or grab for her or anything, she'll zap you and I'll shoot you in the thigh. Then I'll come over there and kick you in the crotch. Repeatedly. I showed no emotion. Just nodded. Get the arms moving, get them moving now. You get the taser away from the girl and immobilize John with it. Move, move, move. Feeling rushed into my right arm. I could flex the muscles all the way up. I was sure I could get it to respond. I focused everything on readying the limb for a quick, violent move. A chop to the throat. Make her drop the taser. Chrissy handed the pistol to John. She came around me, pressed the taser against my shoulder with her left hand. With her right, she reached around her neck and took off her gold necklace, the one with the dangling cross.
What the?
She dropped the necklace over my head at the exact moment I swung my fist. My stomach clenched, my hand frozen in midair.
It's poison. They've coated it with some kind of toxin that can seep through my skin like a nicotine patch, into my bloodstream, eating through my lungs and liver like acid.
I thrashed away from her and got my hands up, but my coordination was even more screwed now than from the taser. I fought like a toddler, my body convulsed, organs thrashing around inside like they were making a jailbreak for my gut. I fell. Hard. Hands on my arm. Soft hands. The girl. Everything stopped. The seizure, or whatever the hell it was, ended abruptly. I was tired, confused. I blinked, trying to take in my surroundings. I sat up and saw the girl stumbling as if she had been cracked over the head with a pipe, dazed out on her feet. She bent down at the waist, breathing hard. She vomited on the floor. I felt like doing the same. I had this greasy feeling like I was rid of something unclean, like I had just passed a tapeworm. And there was this lingering sick shame, the feel of a man who sobers up just enough to realize he's been making out with his best friend's mother. John stared at Chrissy, terrified. He turned on me, questioning, suspicious.
"What are you looking at me for?" I shouted. "Go help her, you ass!"
John nodded, apparently convinced that I was fine. Chrissy was not fine. Chrissy was screaming. She went to her knees, then thrashed onto her back. I scrambled to my feet, moved toward her. John grabbed my jacket, holding me back.
"No," I screamed. "It's in her. The thing is in her. Let me touch her. Let it pass back into me, and then shoot me in the temple."
"Not today."
"It's killing her."
"No, it's not. She's killing it."
"What?"
Chrissy looked up at us with eyes that had turned bloodshot pink. Sweat-soaked hair hanging down in strands. There was a deep, black hatred in that stare, so profound that it was like a punch in the gut. I had never seen anything approaching that look on a human face before. The intelligence behind it was so hateful it was alien, unfeeling, unreasoning, infinitely terrible. "I serve none but Korok, a blue eye in the darkness. He controlled you just like the cockroaches." I wanted to curl up into a fetal position and start sucking my thumb, let my tears and dripping saliva pool under me.
"Sorry.
I tried living, tried being sentient. Can't do it. Can't live in the same universe with that." She screamed again, loud. Opera singer loud, impossibly loud. She clutched at her hair and pressed her eyes closed. A sound erupted in the air around us, a long roar like an ocean wave crashing against a dock. Flecks of glass smacked me in the cheek. 100 panes of glass skylight exploded at once, a circular wave of airborne shards overhead, spreading like a ripple in a pond. Glass poured down around us, a high-pitched ringing as shards pelted the floor, raining down on our heads and shoulders. Silence. She lay still.
"Whoa. She's dead. No. Chest moving. Breathing.
Move! Move!" John pulling at my sleeve, lifting Chrissy to her feet. A metal beam crashed down behind her. The room was coming apart. We ran, half dragging her out of the food court. Ceiling trusses and light fixtures and cables and boards and glass came down in an avalanche. We tumbled through the gate and into the hall, falling on our asses. The entire food court ceiling collapsed behind us, debris piling in front of the door, a wave of compressed air and dust rushing past us like a sandstorm. Chrissy tried to sit up, looking utterly exhausted,
She wiped grit from her eyes. I took the necklace from around my neck and handed it to her. She took it without hesitation, put it on.
She broke it, John said. Like a fever. It passed from you into her. But it couldn't live in her.
He turned his attention to the girl.
How do you feel?
Like I could sleep for 1,000 years.
My bullet had creased John's scalp, and he said he was okay, but damn did it bleed a lot. The wad of shirt he held against it was soaked.
We wandered around the mall looking for Molly and any additional monsters. Nothing, on both counts. Chrissy stayed with Wexler, calling for an ambulance on her cell. She insisted he was alive, though we could see no sign of it. Then, as the first sirens faded in from the distance, Wexler climbed into consciousness long enough to smile at Chrissy, brush a strand of hair out of her face with his fingers. He said something to her that we couldn't hear, and wasn't any of our business anyway. Paramedics arrived with many, many questions. John told them the truth, and I mean he literally told them I was possessed and that killing the demon destroyed the food court. He refused treatment. After the ambulance left, we made our way out to Chrissy's car. She asked John, "Are you going to get your head looked at?"
"Nah, it's just a cut. I was going to shave my head anyway. Are you going to go see Danny in the hospital?"
"Yeah, but there's something I'm supposed to do first. He asked me if I had watched the tape. Do you know what that's about?"
I said no, and John said yes simultaneously. "The video he was shooting," John said, "in his apartment."
A half hour later, Chrissy sat down on the couch in Wexler's apartment while John rewound the tape and let it play. Wexler, looking tired and beaten, appeared on the screen as before.
"Hi, honey. Are you there? Answer me if you're there."
Chrissy looked at us, confused. We had no answers. She turned her eyes back to the screen, waiting.
"Come on. It's okay. Just say hello."
Hello, said Chrissy, looking embarrassed. A tear ran down her cheek.
"Danny, you look awful."
"I know. It's been a rough couple of weeks," Danny said, replying to the camera a full 3 hours before Chrissy made that comment.
"Baby, I've done something really stupid. I've gotten wrapped up in something, something you can't imagine."
"What?" said Chrissy, sobbing.
"What did you get into?"
"If I told you the details, you would wish I hadn't. But you know by now that I'm not myself. I come and go. And right now I'm fine, but I have to fight for every second of control. It's draining. Baby, it takes so much energy to keep myself on top, on the surface, at the wheel. As soon as I relax, he'll take over. It will take over. And I'll be just a spectator. Helpless."
He broke down into sobs. So did Chrissy, sounding utterly drained.
"Are you okay?" he asked, through hitching breaths. "Were you hurt in all of this?" "I'm fine. I'll be fine. This is so strange. I don't even know how I'm doing it. Any of this. Right now I see things, I hear things across time and space, and..."
"It's better if you can put it out of your head, Chris. It's better to live the rest of your life believing things like this aren't possible. But there's other things I need to tell you. Things I've been wanting to say for a long time. And if I'm still alive, I probably won't have the courage to say them in person. But first..."
Wexler's eyes shifted slightly. A chill ran down my spine. He was looking at me. I shifted to my left a couple of feet, and his eyes followed me. He said,
"You're David Wong?"
"No."
"Say no."
"Yeah, I guess."
"Video conferencing across time? Man, I need pie, and fast."
"I don't know all the details. Things are confused in my mind right now. But you're under the eye. You understand what I'm saying, don't you?"
I found I couldn't answer. My mouth had gone so dry, it had glued shut.
"David, you alone fully understand what is at stake here."
1,000 questions popped into my mind, but all I could do was peel my lips apart and say,
"But I don't..."
before trailing off.
"Chris and I need to have a private conversation now, okay?
Glad you made it out alive."
I begged off from John's offer to stay the night at his place and drink many beers with him. I was hungry and had something else to take care of first. I took a cab to McDonald's and had it dump me in the parking lot. I took a deep breath, steeled myself, and approached the sign. I prayed I'd find it back to normal.
Nope. There was Ronald, cutting himself, gutting himself, eating himself. I felt something rigid in my jacket pocket and pulled out a rusty utility razor I didn't remember putting in there. I dropped it like it was a rattlesnake, then picked it up with two fingers and threw it in a trash can. I stared down the poster again. I was hungry. The inside of the restaurant was closed, but they did have a 24-hour drive-through. I walked up to it, and shivering in the chill of the autumn air, ordered two bratwurst. I sat on the curb across the parking lot, and looking right at the sign the whole time, ate them both. Arnie rolled to a stop in the weed and dirt field that would have been the mall parking lot had they ever gotten around to paving it. "So," Arnie said, "Christian mints, crosses, Bibles. This whole long story is just an elaborate setup to get me to subscribe to guideposts, isn't it? You're going to leave me with pamphlets and pictures of Jesus, then go start telling this whole story to the next sinner? Got to be less roundabout ways, Wong." "Nope. That stuff, the crosses and all that, either it works because we think it works, or because the bad guys think it works. Or maybe there's some power everybody can tap into if they just know how. It's Scientology, isn't it?" I said, "We never saw Chrissy or Wexler again. Not even on TV. They moved out of town as soon as he got out of the hospital. Together. So yeah, he was porking her." He squinted at the sprawling skeleton of the mall and said, "This is the place. You think a town could have two places like this?" I ran my hands through my hair and stared at the darkened sockets on the decomposing mall where windows should have been. I heard the faint sound of a plastic tarp snapping in the breeze somewhere. "You scared, Arnie?" "Should I be? Is this place haunted?" "Nothing so simple as that. I wish it were. You say it's haunted and you picture the ghost of some old lady wandering around aimlessly. The things that come and go around here, I don't know that they were ever human. Or maybe they just don't remember it. Try to imagine a Hitler or a Vlad the Impaler or even the nasty old man at the dump who steals people's cats and buries them alive. Now, imagine those guys, but strip them of all their limitations. No bodies, so they never die or run down or get tired. Give them all the time in the world. Imagine that malice, that stupid black mass of hate drifting through eternity, just burning on and on and on like an oil well fire." Arnie waited for me to go on. I didn't. I was realizing all of a sudden how hard it was going to be to tell this next part. I thought it would feel good to unload the whole tale on somebody, but this next bit, this felt more like a confession. I got out of the car and walked toward a concrete ramp, a would-be loading dock for a stillborn mall department store. I heard Arnie's door click and thunk behind me and knew he was following. I said, "There was a girl here in town. She disappeared last year. It wasn't a big story, but you can look it up." "Let me guess. You were the last person to talk to her." I didn't answer. I climbed up the loading ramp and reached a doorway, greeted by the familiar smell of mildew and urine. I tore aside a strip of yellow warning tape and stepped into the cool darkness within. Now, this is going to sound crazy.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.